And kill one.
I've been experiencing this a lot recently. Like, for example, the Canadian government recently came out and said that no amount of alcohol at all is healthy, not even like one drink a year, as if that would impact you at all. Just scientifically, zero alcohol is what should be demanded of everyone. And it really made it feel like, just as you were saying, there's a kind of sacred moment where you're able to share that. There's almost a transgressive act in being able to sit down with friends and commune over this sacred object. Because just like you're saying, when you limit all these things, when you limit alcohol, you're not just limiting alcohol, you're limiting the type of social engagement that accompanies it, and smoking and all those sorts of things.
Absolutely, yes. These are the practices of conviviality and of solidarity. And as it is significant that practices of conviviality always contain a transgressive element. Either you have to drink with alcohol, or in countries where there's a religious prohibition, you have, for example, commit an enormous expenditure. Yeah? If there are people married, they have to invite like 200 people. Yeah? They are petty bourgeois people, yeah? But it's an enormous expenditure. You have to be generous to an extreme amount and to an extreme extent. And so we have to consider that transgression is a key element of solidarity. And this is, I think, one point that has never been properly understood in Georges Bataille, who is the theorist of transgression. But he makes it very clear. He says culture is not founded on a prohibition, like the prohibition of incest, but actually the taboo of incest is an imperative to transgression, an imperative to generosity. It's the same imperative that we feel, for example, if we have a bottle of champagne at home, that we cannot drink it all alone. That would be somehow nasty and greedy. No? If we have the bottle of champagne, we have to invite people and share it with them. No? And this is the imperative of culture, and the taboo is not to share it. Right? So the transgression to drink champagne is actually something that leads into the symbolic order. Transgression is equivalent to what psychoanalysts call symbolic castration. It leads into the symbolic order. It leads into solidarity and conviviality. And not transgressing, just staying healthy, never drinking alcohol, never smoking, and so on, that is actually a narcissistic stance. And precisely what the taboo forbids. You must not do that. You must never become like that. No, this is a taboo. And so transgressive elements are absolutely necessary for solidarity and conviviality.
That's great. You mentioned also how faith is gaining traction in today's world. I assume goes along with this kind of narcissistic mentality of preserving your health.
Right. Yes. I think there's a kind of neoliberal ideology that was very much promoted by postmodern thought, postmodernism. Just stick to your own thing. Only do what you really like. Only accept what you really want. Only be what you really are. So on. No? So in all matters, sexual matters, enjoyment matters, pleasures, we were constantly interpolated to stick to our own and not to alienate and so on. Not the point is here, I think, that what gets destroyed is actually this fear of what sociologist Richard Sennett has called public man. Well, We are not only people who are private idiots, as the Greeks called it. Yeah? You were an idiot if you were only concerned about the private matters, how your private business was going on and how your private bank account ran and so on. But we are also political beings. We are also public beings. We consider what is good for everybody, how the world should look in 15 years and so on, how society should look and so on. And this makes us political beings. And for that kind of existence, we need a second mode of existence where we have to be polite, generous, where we have to leave our true identity behind to a certain extent and more generous, more elegant, more polite and so on, because only that allows us to accede to this public level of life. And if there is a description of what neoliberalism has done in the last decades, I would say it tackled precisely those areas of conviviality where people could solidarize and experience the fact that they are not just private beings. So privatization as the key program of neoliberalism did not only concern businesses and public transport and education and health, but it also concerned the way, let's say, how life was designed. The public spheres of our private lives were constantly cut down and we were more and more reduced to only accepting what we privately like. But actually, this is very, very digital. As a psychoanalyst, I can tell you what we desire from our own is normally very, very digital. It's not that we have some true desires as a private account that we always harbor in ourselves. Actually, desire is always something that is created in the interstices between people. Yeah? So just imagine, for example, you're meeting a friend for a coffee and all of a sudden the friend sees in the newspaper announced a new movie and he says, come on, Michael, wouldn't you like to go with me to this new movie? And you say maybe, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's go to this movie. But neither of you alone would have had the inspiration or the idea or the wish strong enough that would have brought you to the movie. It's just the idea that you're coming together and maybe now you could do something that you alone would never do. That is in a way how our desire is created. I think this is also very important with regard to what is discussed now with regard to sexual morals, that people have to say before what they really want and then only do what they really want. But this is not how sexuality as a sacred matter functions. This is something that is created in the interspace. It's between people and neither of these people may have wanted everything in advance. Mm-hmm. But this is a desire that is somehow dialectically constructed between the people who are engaged in it.
That reminds me, Robert, do you know the example from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with jump humping? Are you familiar with this?
No, please tell me.
So the idea is it's a sexual practice that gets called soaking or marinating or floating. So basically someone inserts the penis into the vagina without thrusting. And it's kind of like a loophole on the ban of premarital intercourse. So it involves the help of a third person to bounce on the bed while a couple is lying, engaged in this act of soaking, right? Making the couple not responsible for the motion itself, the act. So it's a response to religious prohibition of enjoyment, but it makes explicit or articulates this third virtual point. You have the objective status of the scene, and the idea is who is this clumsy workaround staged for? Who is this naive observer?
Mm-hmm. Right, yes. Who is supposed to believe this?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, it's funny because actually it introduces a dimension of obscenity which is foreign to most of more narcissistic people, no? We don't have so many problems with premarital sex. Maybe we never marry, but still have sex. But we would maybe hesitate to involve a third person for these actions. No? Usually this is what leads into I don't know, pervert orgies and so on. Sure. As more than people are involved, it gets a little strange, no? And it's only for experts. But it's funny that in this religion conditions, this is better than just two people having real sex.
Yeah.
And of course, we see that funny types of illusions are around in these contexts, no? Who's there to believe that this is not real sex just because this third idiot sounds
right. With that example, it's like there's the delegation of responsibility on the third person rather than the delegation of enjoyment. And before the interview started, we were talking about whether cuck holding is into passive.
Right. Difficult to tell here. Yeah. You could argue this under the condition that you claim that, the motoric action is the pleasure and the sin. No? If that is the sin, then of course the pleasure is delegated to the motoric agent. And if it's the pleasure, then in the silly terminology of interactivity theory, it is the passivity. No? Although this guy is the one who sweats most, maybe. But since it's the pleasure, it's the passivity.
One also wonders what kind of God could create the world, but also be fooled that he kind of left out the idea that someone could get work around premarital sex by... It's okay.
Yes, true. Yes. It's at the same time a very wise and God. No, this is also typical for the history of religion. No? The later a religion comes, the more sex negative are its gods. Earlier religion is, if it has gods at all, which is not the case for all religions. But if it has gods, the early gods are always very sex positive. And only later on they get so wise and sex negative. But at the same time, this funny god gets wise but naive at the same time and trick this god with a very simple trick that every human being would immediately see through.
Yeah, because you also have that bit about like you trace the history or trace a history of gods being quite young through to being these older, wiser gods. And rather than a god looking down, you were talking about a god looking from beneath.
Right. Yes, this was my modest contribution to psychoanalytic theory. Freud has, in his second topography of the psychic apparatus, if you know, distinguished like three levels of the psychic apparatus, or it, the ego, and the superego. From the id come the drives, and from the superego come the moral injunctions. And ego has got somehow to negotiate this too. But when we look at how people relate to their pleasures, we can say probably that they do not only follow their drives, but sometimes they have to overcome initial disgust. This is, as a rule, the case with sexuality, for example. No? Most of us would find it normally disgusting to feel somebody else's tongue in one's mouth. So on the normal condition, this is disgusting and unhealthy and whatever. But of course, under the celebrating conditions of sexual act, of an erotic act, it becomes sublime and wonderful. And so this means that we are not spontaneously driven to put our tongues into everybody's mouth. We are not spontaneously heathens. That's the reason why these neoliberal politics are so successful, because people spontaneously hate pleasure because they find it disgusting and unhealthy and annoying and whatever and exhausting. And so actually, often when we indulge in these things and satisfy our drives, actually we are not so much following our inclinations, but we are often following strange duties. We think, okay, normally I'm a shy person, but probably now that I'm in love with this wonderful person, there should be something disgusting going on, and now it will become great. No, but so actually we are transgressive insofar as we overcome our normal limitations, this means that we are not following an inclination, but we are following a duty. So from the id, not only drives are coming, but actually something like silly duties are coming. And sometimes we obey those silly duties when we do sex, drinking, partying, celebrating silly things, then we are following silly gods. We are following like Greek gods or something like that, whom we please and for whom we overcome our personal hesitations. And this is why I think we should consider of a lower agency of observation, an agency that imposes like silly duties upon us. Of course, from the superego come duties that we regard as reasonable and we should be healthy and wealthy and whatever. But from the other side come also imperatives. And so we have to design this lower agency in a way analogous to the superego as also an agency of observation that implies duties to us and that observe us if we follow those duties properly.
How does that tie in with your idea of like that new psychic agency of the naive observer?
Right, yes. You know, superego is a super smart observer, as you know. Superego not only observes your act, but also your intentions. And strangely, and this is the obscene side to the superego, it punishes you for the intentions that you don't follow even more than for those that you follow, and punishes in both cases. What I describe as the name of observer is at work when you follow a silly imperative, something that you, by your better knowledge, disregard as something not necessary, silly, but it has to be done. This is what one should do. Yeah. If a party is celebrated and you are invited, you should go there. It's a bit shameful if you don't, and so on. Yeah. If you follow those imperatives, it shows that you are obeying an instance or an agency of internal observation that functions differently from the superego. In the first place, this observation is naive. It only looks at how things look. It looks only at appearances. It looks if your handshake was performed properly, hard enough, long enough, often enough, whatever. Not a handshake is a quite complicated matter. You can make many mistakes. And then you cannot excuse yourself by claiming that you meant it seriously. Hurt the other's hand by squeezing it too hard, for example. And then you said, oh, I'm so sorry, but I meant it seriously. But then politeness is destroyed. You did it wrong. And this naive observer is not interested in how you meant it. It's just interested in the fact that you do it properly. And so this observer that only cares for appearances, this observer that cares for the illusions without owners that we maintain in life, for example, a generalist, has to be described along these lines. No? In order to explain or to account for what we are doing here, we're caring for appearances, no matter how we mean it, but it has to be done. This requires an explanation, I think, that refers to an internal agency of observation from which this type of obligations stem from.
Yeah, I notice this in drinking games. Like, you'll go to a party, there's always some person who'll be like, it's just a game, I won't drink the shot when I lose, or I won't scull the beer when I lose. And there's this moment in that kind of community where everything falls apart. This person who thinks that they're not duped by the rules of the game. But there's something about it's a sense of decorum almost, right? Like, what glues you together is this sustained community of believers in the efficacy of the rules of the game.
Right. This is a good example, yes. I mean, this is what is usually called spoil sport, no? That declares the game silly and stops the game and spoils it, no? This can also happen with other games, football or whatever. No, you decide you play football and all of a sudden somebody says, oh, why should I kick this ball into this ball? You see, it's similar. I hit it, stop it. No? So every game, in a way, presupposes a certain belief. Well, this is what theorist of the game, Johann Heusinger, has nicely described in his book Homo Ludens from 1938. Mm-hmm. So there's what Manoni calls belief is at work in every game. There is a certain illusion. We have the illusion that the ball has got to go into the goal, or the chess figure has to do this and that and so on. So there are goals that have to be reached, and playing means to accept the belief at work here. It's not a faith. It can never be appropriate because you know quite well this is a game. No? So this is again this type of illusion that we have to call belief. You know quite well, but still it has to be done. And this point sport is the one that retreats to the side of I know quite well and treats the others as if they didn't know quite well.
Yeah.
Razor position. The savages believe in magic, I don't, and that's why I don't do it. No? But this is not the difference between the two of them. This is just the difference is that both know, but they draw different conclusions from that knowledge. Mm-hmm. The savages, for example, do funny things, knowing that they are silly, but precisely because they know that they are silly, they can find them funny. No, the right. Same as with carnival. No? Of course, you can put on a red nose, and of course, you know that this is silly, but you can do it because knowing it, you know it's funny. But on the other hand, you can say, oh, these are people from lower classes or from less enlightened groups, and they do these things because they don't know that it's stupid. I know it, and therefore I abstain from this. So that's the position of the spoil sport. I think this is precisely because you made this nice quote, not duped, no?
Yeah,
they believe not to be duped, no? And I think this can be nicely connected to a quote by Jacques Lacan, les non-dupes errent, no? The non-dupes are in error. No? This is precisely this, when you don't accept that this is a belief and not a matter of ignorance. And this is always split into two levels. I know quite well, but still I do it. No? And when you just fall on the side of knowledge and think that from that you have to conclude not to do it. But this is a key error and maybe a key naivety. Naivety, yeah? You say in English, naivety, yeah?
This is not a meaningful theoretical question, but Robert, I was listening to, do you know Todd McGowan, the Y Theory?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Todd and his co-host Ryan were talking about your theory of interpassivity, and they wondered whether or not you were a fan of sports. So I pose the question to you. Are you a fan of sports?
Yes, I have to admit, I haven't been so much all of my life. I was, of course, in my youth, and then later on, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we were a bit reluctant against sports, intellectuals, people in art and so on. We were a bit despising of sports or sports in a way. Mm-hmm. But somehow secretly, soon we started again playing football amongst each other and Austria skiing in winter. And so I actively do some of these sports. And I am a passionate sports observer. I watch ski races and football games and some other events. And I indulge in these beliefs. I know it is quite silly, but when Saturday comes, I have to watch British soccer.
Yeah. We also follow passionately British soccer. Who do you like to watch?
Who do I like to watch?
Mm.
Well, In England, I don't have a favorite team. This English Premier League system is so super capitalized that to a certain extent, I find it disgusting, and I find it disgusting how they buy all these expensive players. But on the other hand, of course, I have to admire how they play and what with super coaches they have, how they manage to let these teams really work as teams. I mean, it is wonderful to see these people at Arsenal, for example, playing now. Rüdiger was like a sleeper for years, but now really starts shining. This is wonderful. But my secret enjoyments are, of course, those when some underdogs of all of a sudden a team consisting almost of nobodies acquires brilliance, like this season, for example, Napoli.
Napoli, yeah.
Unfortunately, they have been beaten last weekend, and I hope that this will not break them, but they have been incredible this season. And I don't know, I knew one single player of this team, or Di Lorenzo. He's a team national team player in Italy, but I wouldn't have known any of the other names in this team. And I think many of the experts would have agreed that they didn't know any. And did you know Klicha Kvaratskhelia, the left offensive player of Napoli? Nobody knew him in Europe before, but this is at the moment maybe one of the best offensive football players in Europe. Or somehow comparable successes of Ajax Amsterdam in the last years. This was also very remarkable for a team that is not such a rich feat. Or also Benfica Lisbon, who's here, with the former coach of Salzburg, Austrian football team, Roger Schmidt. They now perform wonderfully.
Yeah, Napoli, it was like a brand new team practically at the beginning of the season because they had to sell all their players, right?
Right.
And there's that magic there.
So surprising that this team all of a sudden is so successful.
I had a similar experience with sports. Well, I played it when I was a kid and got away from it in my 20s and thought that sports was stupid and that anyone that liked sports was kind of idiotic for liking them. And then during the pandemic, it was kind of, as you know, the kind of closest thing to something happening in the world. It also had a very strange iteration in the sense that it didn't have a crowd, which we thought was an interesting example of interpassivity in that sense, where they were playing the crowd sounds, like canned laughter, during the game, when of course there wasn't a crowd there. But yeah, I had that similar thing of like realizing that sports was something that you could believe in on the level of, yes, knowing that it's just a game, but also something that contains like a different element to it that is not simply a kind of being duped by whatever the spectacle of it or something.
Do you know, in Australian rules football, the main slogan is more than a game?
Well, with Johan Huizinga, I would answer there's nothing that is more than a game. No? Precisely the game is what brings about an excitement that we rarely find in any other circumstances. No? I mean, my goal in soccer has brought me to embrace and kiss foreigners in a bar.
Yeah. There's no reaction like a reaction to a goal. Nothing else in the world can make you do that.
Right. No.
Yeah.
And this is what Huizinga, I think, calls a sacred seriousness of game. Mm-hmm. In no other condition we are in this psychic status of sacred seriousness. We get totally excited. We're totally solidary with some other unknown people. This collective effervescence only occurs in conditions of play, and this is why we should take play seriously. Also as a sort of culture and solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Could you see it related to what you were saying about the little enjoyments? There's an element of danger in play as well.
Yes, of course, yes. And there's a lot of dangers connected to play, because this excitement that somehow raise your mood, they can also be addictive. There's a strong connection between the sacred and the addiction. And of course, people are addicted to many of these things, especially addicted to things that happen on screens. You don't find so many addicted football fans who go to the stadium. Mm-hmm. That was possible once a week, twice a week, maybe, but that's it. But but people who are addicted to watching on the screen, they might feel empty on a day when there is no bigger game on, for example. And that's a mark of addiction. You feel empty when there is nothing going on. The other people are happy if there are a few days of how do you say,
respite.
Yes, of where you can recover and then get it again. So the kind of ways in your emotional life. But the addicts somehow cannot do without this constant excitement. And that's the danger that is pretty proper to game situations. And even other things that are addictive, like smoking or drinking alcohol, I think should be regarded under this respect. It's not only the toxic substance, but it's also the attraction of a certain behavior. So there are behavior addictions. So we are addicted to do certain things, and they have to be done more often and more frequently and more, especially if they are not able to interrupt our profane everyday actions. Well, I think this is where the addictions come in. When I smoke, under the condition that I interrupt work, don't think of work, that it becomes a sacred ritual with all the framings that sacred things have got. It's not allowed to interrupt. It's not allowed to have servers and so on. It's an intimate situation with calm and certain concentration. Then it's a real ritual. But if you profanize it and if you work on the screen and smoke aside, smoking does not interrupt anymore. And then it easily becomes addictive because it doesn't fulfill the function of interruption. And that's why it has to be repeated. The repetition comes in where something fails.
Very nice. And the kind of newest form of, this seems like the example or the instance in which the kind of neoliberal era sort of devalues this kind of level of enjoyment is, I don't know if you know about this, but of course you watch sports, but the prominence of sports betting now on people's phones is kind of incredible. My wife's little brother is 18 years old and he's got friends in his high school who are betting on their phones on sports games. Games that they don't even necessarily watch, you know. This seems like a perversion of the, like you were just saying, of the kind of sacred element.
Right. Yes. Yes. I think phones play a terrible role with regard to this. Things that you had to share before, you can now have in private and separated from others. So they promote isolation. And that's precisely why these moments are not sacred anymore, no? And that's why people get so addicted, because they don't share it with others. It's not the company that helps them to transform these ugly things into sublime things, but it's now their single private obscene passion, and that is dangerous with regard to addiction. Even I think this displacement from the fascination of the game to the fascination of betting is a questionable displacement. Can you not watch soccer because you like soccer?
Exactly. Yeah.
Does that mean that enjoyment has to be shared in order for it to be sacred?
Yes. To a certain extent, yes. I think, of course, it is possible to be polite alone. you dress nicely, you kind of maintain a certain appearance even if you are alone at home, or you put the nice plates on the table and the candle and nice glasses and do it as if other people are around. But in order to be able to do that, you have to have learned it in collective all circumstances. So the collective life of ritual is, I think, the school for such rituals, and you have to have become quite some expert in order to be able to do it alone for yourself. Alone, we are pretty profane people, and we are pretty coward people who shy away from all the transgressions that on rituals oblige us to commit.
I was thinking about you're talking about phones, and my brother has three young girls, And I've noticed that with him and his wife, all of their experiences are mediated by a phone. So the parents are constantly filming the children doing things, photographing them, filming them, etc. And we know that they'll never go back and ever look through all of this content, right?
Yes.
And I wondered a lot when reading both of those books, Into Passivity and Illusions Without Owners, what is it about the manner in which we experience our enjoyment that pushes us to delegate it to other people? So is the idea that there's something excessive about enjoyment that we are trying to avoid? I note that you don't use the word outsource. So we don't outsource enjoyment and we don't outsource work, which is something that I've seen a lot when people are writing about interpassivity. They talk about outsourcing work, but you don't talk about it that way. What is it that we're trying to avoid when we delegate enjoyment?
This is a very good question. It bothered me for a long time. And maybe my answer is still provisory. In the first place, of course, with regard to what we have talked before, I think there might be a certain desire to share things. So when we see an incredible monument, pyramid, let's say, we immediately tend to protect our eyes with our phone. We somehow, like a screen, we put something between us and this sublime object. But also maybe with this idea that we want to share this experience, at least with the device or with the people that we might show it to later. So again, there is a kind of surplus that we want to share, and we immediately somehow recognize the situation as a sacred one by doing this. So it's not just a profane encounter, hello pyramid, it's me, Robert, but it's a kind of sacred situation that I am exposed to this sublime thing. And this is why I try to call in the collective that somehow would help me to turn this situation into a celebrated situation. I can somehow respond to the sublimity of the object. Secondly, of course, we might feel somehow not capable enough to comply to the majesty of the object or to the enormous impact of the object, or to maybe also to the overflow of the object. This sitcom on television, and I would prefer it to laugh about itself, because I would feel incapable to do all this amount of enjoyment that is expected from me. So I think this is where interpassivity comes in. Like Zizek says, I would be completely exhausted if I had to pay attention what these comedies, what kind of jokes these comedies are making. And so I'm happy if this laughs about itself. So interpassivity is a kind also of acknowledgement of the limitation of our capacity to enjoy. We act a little bit as if it were bigger, and it is bigger under collective context. If we are left alone, we are pretty poor with regard to these things, and we somehow acknowledge this poverty by involving this interpassive media that do a good part of it in our place.
Has have new technology led to a greater rise in what you would think of as interpassive enjoyment?
Well, I wouldn't say so. Also, classic examples of interpassivity theory, like for example, an early example that Zizek gave, you remember, were the Tibetan prayer wheels.
Yeah, right, of course.
Zizek explains this very nicely in this typical style, where he says, I take this wheel and I put the little prayer written on a paper into it, and then I turn this wheel, and meanwhile I can think of many things, my most obscene fantasies. It doesn't matter, because objectively I'm still praying. or you can also write it on a flag and put the flag into the wind, and the wind will somehow move the flag.
Right. Yeah.
Phrase. And even the Dalai Lama himself has said, also a computer can be used as a prayer. You just have to write the prayer on your screen and save it.
Yeah. And the Dalai Lama is fairly confused about technology, I think.
Yeah. The heart describes a certain speed, and that's also...
All right.
When he himself said that, I mean, I find that pretty remarkable, because I expected anybody else saying that would be regarded as blasphemy, which is foreign probably to our types of religion.
You're breaking up a little bit here on your internet connection, I think, Robert.
It's by the winter subjects. Yeah, these guys are pretty relaxed and are happy with something with praying. In this context, we also have to consider that the matter is sacred again, and that this is somehow too much of an expectation for a single individual. Huh? And therefore, this huge amount of sacredness has to be somehow digested by machines. You cannot know. Apparently, we have managed to minimize the sacred so that we can be single, faithful, religious people, some of us. But at that time, the religious thing was so big that they had to use machines to cope with it.
Right.
So it's funny that in religious history, we observe a kind of deindustrialization. In former times, religions had more religious machines, whereas we are now more on the status of do-it-yourself level.
Hmm. Right.
It's understandable, right? For the mother with the phone example I was using before, there's a duty to enjoy, and there's a kind of interpolation from the child to the mother, like, you are my mother. And there's a distance from which you want to identify with that subject position. You need to mediate it with the phone in order to have some distance rather than being overdetermined by that symbolic position. It's the too muchness of the hail, mother.
Right. Yes. And I think I can very well understand that. No? And with smaller things, no? When all of a sudden, for example, you discover a balloon in the sky above you, you may feel a certain temptation to tell it to somebody else. No?
Yeah.
Look, there's a balloon in the sky. No? And so there's a certain too muchness of this experience for yourself alone. You want to share it, no? This is also generous in a way, no? Like when you win a bottle of wine or you win a certain amount of money, maybe by betting, no?
Yeah.
You also feel inclined not to spend it alone, but...
No, that's right. You shout around for everybody at the bar when you win that bet.
Right, yes.
Yeah, like a lottery win would be the same thing, right? Like the injunction is that you would share it in order to enjoy it, because to enjoy it privately would be obscene.
Right. Yes.
I felt very silly this morning when I was reading through some of your work and when we were discussing interpassivity, because I was at a concert last night and I was filming some of it to send to my friends, which of course I didn't do at all. I didn't send it, but I have it. With the possibility that I could.
Yes. I mean, there are all dimensions at work, no? It's too much for me now. It deserves to be observed more than once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to share it with friends. No?
Yeah. I'll watch it back and think to myself, oh, look at that time when I was enjoying myself.
Yeah. Actually, you were just busy with recording.
Yeah, with the hopes that I would enjoy it in the future. So like in both situations, there's like...
So you dedicate back and forth in time.
Yeah.
But that was one of your points, Robert, about sport, how watching a replay or a non-live game has no joy in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that was a funny point I noticed. I was at that time in the 90s, I was video recording a lot, and that functioned perfectly. There were good movies on television sometimes, more often than now, and I recorded a lot in order to be able to watch later, or I noticed that I sometimes didn't watch later. But what never functioned for me, and I asked some friends and they told me the same. I couldn't record football games, no?
Mm.
And I asked myself why. And then a very clever friend of mine, stage designer Ulf Stengen, who lives in Berlin, once told me, Robert, I have found the solution why you can't watch a recorded football game, because it is because you are not able to influence it anymore. And I thought, fantastic, because when I sit there without knowing it or without believing it, I am still a bit influencing the game. Or I say, pass it on to the right wing player and shoot. and I'm very happy if they do what I want.
yeah. Yelling at it when it's not going well. Yeah.
Right.
Does this mean that this is something that I find funny about theorists when they'll describe the actions of somebody stupid in order to conceal the fact that they themselves do it? So your example here, and then we know of Zizek with canned laughter. Do you open the newspaper and go straight to the horoscopes?
Well, the horoscopes are not my passion, but I go to the sports. I know that politics and culture are more important for my life, but I cannot abstain myself of looking even into minor football games sometimes. I think this is in a way the fun that theory brings about. It gives us a lot of chance to laugh about ourselves, no? As we mentioned Zizek, but also Wittgenstein with his example about himself. No, I'm biting on my teeth very silly.
Yeah.
Still I'm doing it.
And wasn't it
the guy who liked games?
Wittgenstein, yeah, of course. Actually.
Because it reminded me, like, I heard an anecdote you were saying, Robert, about being at a conference with Zizek, and he was going along. Yes.
That was very nice. In Oxford, I think it was 2006, British Society of Phenomenology had dedicated its annual meeting to Zizek's work. Zizek was there, and many scholars who had worked upon Zizek were there as well. And we had very funny talk during all the conference. Zizek was replying very well to all these contributions. And in the last coffee break, Zizek had to leave the conference on the third day. And we were just standing there with our coffee cups, like in the rows. And Zizek left and said to every scholar there, goodbye, thank you, goodbye, goodbye. And I was, by coincidence, the last in that row. And I think I was the only one who knew Zizek already for more than 15 years. And when Zizek came up to me, he said, and fuck you. Of course, because this showed that Zizek was not just polite to me, but he really considered me as a true intimate friend with whom he exchanged such an obscenity and such a split between the level of the enunciated content and the level of enunciation. No?
Mm-hmm.
This was his way of truly honoring me as a true friend and not as a stupid guy who doesn't understand that this is the most nicest thing that he could say to me at this moment.
Beautiful. Well, maybe we can leave it there for this time. Robert, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you all. It's been my pleasure.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe it'll be the pleasure of the people that are listening to it, you know. Once. Great. Thank you so much. Thanks again.
Thank you, guys.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And so on.